It's Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, our guest says it's time to quit writing those cookie-cutter annual holiday letters. Nobody believes them anyway, she says.
But first, yesterday, the Milwaukee County District Attorney announced that former Milwaukee police officer Christopher Manny will not be charged in the shooting death of Dontre Hamilton. It's the latest in a number of cases nationwide where police officers have not been indicted for police-involved deaths.
Protesters are still demonstrating in New York City after an NYPD officer wasn't charged in a choking death there. And there's still unrest in Ferguson, Missouri, as Officer Darren Wilson walked away without getting an indictment there.
These cases indicate that it's difficult to indict a police officer for on-duty deaths. For an explanation as to why that is, we've called on Kimmy King. She's a professor of political science at the University of North Texas. Kimmy, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be here.
Now, we've heard about these high-profile situations where people haven't been indicted. Is it true? Is it difficult to indict police officers who shoot people on duty?
It is extremely difficult to indict officers for a number of different reasons. The larger issue is that it's quite striking because most typically grand juries do indict. So to the average person accused of a crime, in the most recent study we have from 2010, out of 162,000 federal cases, only 11 wound up with no true bills, meaning that they kicked them out. Everything else of those 162,000 went forward. Yet when you look around the country, you see repeatedly in looking at police homicide cases that those numbers just simply are not comparable.
So basically, if a normal person, or not a normal person, but a person who's not a police officer, the average person, shoots somebody, they're going to wind up in a trial. But for police, it's different.
Yeah, and I will draw on, for example, in Texas, in my state here, Texas grand juries in Houston haven't indicted a Houston police officer since 2004, although there have been allegations of upwards of 288 police use of force that resulted in a homicide. In Dallas grand juries, in reviewing 81 shootings in the last 4 years, only one officer was indicted. So it happens quite frequently. Now, one thing that I would point out is there is a case that most people are not looking at that happened down in North Carolina with an officer, Randall Carrick. And he had initially not been indicted, but then the prosecutor was required to recuse himself for having a conflict of interest. When it was turned over to the state's attorney general office, the officer was indicted. So this idea that it's always the case is simply not true. It just depends on the method that the prosecutor goes through.
Now, could you help us understand what a district attorney or a grand jury would be looking for when they're trying to determine whether or not to indict somebody?
Sure. And remember, in a grand jury case, all you're looking for is probable cause that a criminal act occurred, and then that refers it on to what we know as the petite jury, which is the trial jury. It's what we usually think of when we think about American jury trials. And so prosecutors have to make a determination about whether or not they're going to proceed with the criminal charges, and so they will do an investigation. And what you see in that regard is that there are really three different things that are operating in a grand jury involving a police officer. One is juror bias, two is prosecutorial bias, and three is prosecutorial discretion. And it's that latter category that gets so many folks up in arms. And, you know, prosecutors feel compelled to bring a case, even if that case might be weak. And as a consequence, then, there can be problems.
So why do they not do that with police officers as often, do you think?
When you look at police officers, so for one, when it does get referred to, so the first instance, the prosecutor referring it, prosecutors need the police. They need law enforcement. Remember, in all of their other criminal cases that go on every other day of the year, police departments need to have a relationship with the low school district attorney, and the district attorney also needs to have a relationship with the prosecutor, with the local officers. And so it's that relationship that can oftentimes be the source of difficulty because there's a reluctance to kind of go after what's seen as one of their own. And then even if they do get to a grand jury, remember, grand jurors tend to trust police officers. We rely on them to keep us safe. And if you look at studies of when officers are not prosecuted, if they show remorse, if they say it's part of their training, if they say they acted in self-defense, they are much more likely not to be indicted.
And so, I mean, so in some ways, maybe the bias is justified that people believe police officers are doing a difficult job in protecting the citizens.
Correct.
But isn't there also a risk that if police officers aren't indicted and you see a lot of high profile issues like this, that the trust of the police could actually be affected in a negative way as well?
Correct. And it's on this issue of excessive use of force that gets the public so triggered by these different incidents and what has really and I would also point out, this is something we've been going through since the 1960s. This is not new. If you go back in time, there have always been these high profile cases of excessive use of police force. In fact, the very idea of having police review boards, and I noted that Governor Walker is looking at trying to change the law now in the state of Wisconsin over this. There have always been these issues of how we review what police officers do. And is it better to let a grand jury and a prosecutor make those determinations, or should we let it be up to the lawmaking process that goes through reform? But the reality is we've been going through this since the 1960s, and I think that's part of the level of frustration you see in the reaction that you get from the public about these issues.
Do you think that public reaction could have an impact on things? I mean, I suppose this is something that would probably have to go higher than local district attorneys, right?
Well, one thing that you're seeing increasingly as a response to this is that you remove the local prosecutor from the equation. So it either gets turned over to a state attorney general or it goes to federal prosecutors, that there's been a violation of federal civil rights. And so for those people who are unhappy about police behavior, you know, my suggestion would be that is the route that you go for some reform, is that you remove that local connection on the investigation, which is what contributes to this concern that there is this juror bias and this prosecutor bias.
Here in Milwaukee, it was a district attorney who was reviewing the case and ultimately making the decision. In other places like Ferguson, they have a grand jury. Were grand juries used in some places to try to overcome a situation where there might be a perception that the district attorney is making?
Oh, absolutely. And you see that, like, for example, in the North Carolina case. I mean, you see that there. Here's another thing that's part of the system, and that is, even if you get it away from prosecutorial discretion, like what y'all have there in Wisconsin, another thing that prosecutors can do is that they can order a special grand jury. When you order a special grand jury, that subjects it to a much longer process. It means there's more investigation. Special grand juries are impaneled for longer periods of time. They have the ability to call witnesses. And so what can happen there is that in the course of that investigation, you have the ability to either make the case or to break the case. And so that's another thing that can happen. And for example, in that North Carolina case, it was an additional grand jury being brought forward that did a special investigation that ultimately led to the prosecution of that police officer.
Now, aren't there some people who would criticize that approach and say that it could really slow down things and make it difficult for police officers to do their jobs?
Oh, absolutely. And part of this tension that you see is that who wants to second guess a police officer when he's pulling up to or she is pulling up to the scene of what may be a potential crime? And so in the case of North Carolina, that police officer was responding to a burglary call, and what he came across was a Florida A&M University football player whose car had crashed and he was walking to get help. And so, you know, these are difficult determinations to be made that are on the spot, you know, judgments that have to be called. And that's where you see this tension. I think that in cases like, you know, Ferguson and the Garner case and your case in Wisconsin, it gets very difficult because the broader public comes in and they look at circumstances and the facts of a case and think to themselves, I wouldn't have done that. I wouldn't have thought a police officer would have done that.
Well, the difficult issue, definitely. Thanks so much for talking to us about this.
You betcha. Support public radio, folks. Take care and happy holidays.
And happy holidays to you, too. That was Cami King, a professor of political science at the University of North Texas. Let's talk about those holiday letters. You know what I'm talking about, those mass-produced letters from friends and family that are filling us in on the various benchmarks of the past year, sent out to everybody along with the usual holiday cards, maybe with a photo. Usually they focus on activities, not feelings, and function like a highlight reel of the year.
Well, our next guest has a message for you. Stop sending them. She says they make people feel bad, and what's more, they're redundant in the age of social media. Alyssa Strauss joins us now. She writes about gender and culture, and she wrote a piece on this topic for theweek.com. Alyssa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, you know, we're spread out around the country from friends and family. We want to catch up. What's wrong with the way we send out these classic, here's what happened to us this year, holiday letters?
Well, I think for starters, like, yes, we may be geographically spread out, but the fact is we're all on Facebook, or many of us are on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. So we actually kind of see like a day-by-day, you know, play out of each other's lives on these social media sharing platforms. And, you know, come the holidays end, we know where John got into college. We know about your trip to India. We know that Dad got a promotion. You know, we've heard it. We know, you know, Lily made varsity tennis. So for one, it's, you know, it's not really telling us stuff we don't know.
So are you basically saying we now live in a world where it's just like an endless holiday letter every day?
One giant holiday letter. Kind of. We kind of do. Yeah.
Is that good? I'd rather have one a year.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, it's funny. Okay, so on one hand, we have our kind of like highly curated social media accounts. I mean, some of us, you know, try to only show the nicest, prettiest moments of our lives. And the other of us, some of us actually use social media as a way to confess. So even though it kind of contradicts my first point, the other reason not to do them is that we actually, like, we know it's not true anymore. We're, you know, a decade out from a whole revolution of, you know, what people call mommy blogs on the internet. We've seen every parenting failure documented, you know, through pictures, through blog posts, through videos. Like, the gig is up. We know Leave It to Beaver, like, the fantasy's gone. And so there's really no point in sending this highlights reel come the end of the year when we know that that's just not what life is like.
Well, and as the recipient of that good news thing, yeah, we achieved enlightenment on the top of Mount Everest while playing in the International Rugby League or whatever. What does that do to us? What does that create due to our expectations of life and our view of our own lives?
Right. I mean, with, you know, all this information we're swimming in from, you know, about each other's lives and about the world in general, it's like, you know, people feel bad. I mean, that's, you know, I think there are a number of studies that document how social media, if you know, scrolling on your Facebook feed, actually makes you feel worse after instead of better. And, you know, we're humans. We can't help but compare ourselves. So when we're all, you know, bragging or humble bragging, you know, whichever, we can't help but look at what we see on that page and think like, hey, this actually might be their life and my life looks nothing like this. And, you know, what can I do about it?
Isn't there something nice about it? I mean, it's kind of nice to get a little card from someone. You can keep it. You can look at it over the years, see how people have aged and stuff like that. I mean, what's the harm? What's the harm in sending them out, really?
It's funny. My father-in-law, who's older and an attorney, and he sent me, you know, like a point-by-point reason, you know, a breakdown of why my 5 points, like, he's exempt from them. And I said, you know what? You're right. You are exempt. Like, they make perfect sense in your life. Go, please, you know, write your holiday letter and make sure to brag a lot about me in it. But, no, I think, you know, the point is that we're already putting so much time into staying in touch because of social media that maybe there's a better way, you know, like the time you would use to put together that one-size-fits-all holiday letter, maybe instead use it to write 5 personal letters to, you know, maybe older relatives who aren't on Facebook or someone you've lost touch with and, you know, but always think about, you know, use it to, like, make a real personalized, individualized connection. And for the friends that you are always in touch with via social media, maybe go grab a drink, you know, like try to, you know, that's the stuff that we're missing. We're not in short of information about each other, but we are often missing that kind of an emotional connection. So it's the holidays. You know, go grab some eggnog or a cup glass of, you know, spiced wine and have a nice talk.
Well, the objections people might raise to that, and it may be something they'd talk about in their annual holiday letter, is we're too busy. Our lives are whirlwinds, vortexes of our time. We don't have time to go out and do that stuff. We just have time to talk about how busy we are in our annual holiday letter.
Right. Well, you know, interestingly enough, there's a communications professor in the Midwest, a woman named Ann Burnett, actually has studied holiday letters over the decades, and she found a rise in words like whirlwinds, crazy, hard to keep up with it all, you know, these phrases that denote like, oh, we're just so busy. And, you know, what she's taken away from that is that busyness has really become this status symbol. So, you know, it's like on one hand we are so busy, but on the other hand we're living in this culture that really thinks being busy is great and it's a sign of having made it. So, right, on one hand you may not be able to get the time to away from your family to have a drink with a friend, but when we write these holiday letters, we're often contributing to this culture that makes, you know, busy the most important thing a person can be. And busy, you know, it's a lot about perception. Like, we feel like we're busy because we feel like we're supposed to be busy.
So when you wrote this article, did you feel a little guilty? Did you have this feeling that, like, somebody who sent you a note like this in the past, other than your father, is thinking, oh, man, I'm never talking to her again.
Father-in-law, even worse, yeah.
You're off the mailing list.
I mean, did you feel remotely guilty? Did you feel remotely guilty about it?
Yeah, I didn't want to come off as, you know, some Scrooge, and it's someone's like beautiful tradition, and that I'm just showing them why it's terrible and they should stop doing it. But you know, on the other hand, I feel like we are living in this culture where people feel they're doing a lot out of guilt, particularly mothers, which I write a lot about, and not because it's necessarily something that someone wants to do. You know, this feeling that you have to do something because everyone else is doing it. I believe because of social media, it's stronger than ever. And, you know, this, you know, with helicopter parenting, intensive parenting, this kind of, you know, we can't do enough for our kids these days. So, you know, it's, to me, looking at it with fresh eyes this year, it seemed like one more thing that we, you know, maybe it's time has come. Maybe we don't need anymore. Maybe we shouldn't feel guilty if we're not going to do it. And here's five reasons why you shouldn't feel guilty for not doing it.
You mentioned earlier maybe replacing this tradition, the, you know, the mass mailing to everybody, with the personal letters, especially to maybe older relatives who don't keep up on social media. You also have suggestions in your piece for, you know, the style, not just a checklist of what happened. What would you look for in a good connecting kind of letter?
Right, you know, maybe you have a relative that loves playing tennis, and, you know, you have a daughter or son that just got really into tennis. Maybe they're terrible at it. Maybe they didn't even make the team. But, you know, but you and your daughter go play tennis every Sunday morning, and it's the best part of your week. You know, that's a nice moment to share that doesn't always kind of fit into the holiday letter format, but may mean the world to, you know, your relative that you grew up playing tennis with, or so something along those lines.
You know, say things like, you know, Junior is learning to curse or something like that.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Be more honest. That's what you're saying.
Right. Well, things but also, that matter on, yeah, human level.
Special experiences, not resume items.
Exactly. You know, when you're writing the one-size-fits-all one, you're choosing the things that have the most value in our culture at large, because that's just what makes sense if you're writing to everyone at once. You know, and if you can write a more personal letter, you're choosing the things that the recipient actually cares about. And maybe no one else in the whole world does. Maybe everyone thinks this one television show is the worst, but you know that this relative loves it and you want to share with them how you love it now too.
Do you feel like you're fighting a losing battle, though? Because, I mean, it seems like, you know, it's getting more this way. And I mean, not just because of social media. It seems like, you know, there are a lot of people who probably feel the, you know, when you have a world where you have, if you're on Twitter, you have followers, and if you're on Facebook, you have fans who like things that you do. It seems like there'd be more motivation than ever for people to write these kind of letters and send them out.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, I suspect that, you know, we will reach a point of fatigue before too long. There's been some, you know, good books, one particular book named Overwhelmed by a Washington Post writer named Bridget Schultz that I highly recommend. And, you know, it's all about this feeling, this the overwhelm. And there was a book, you know, maybe 5 or 10 years ago by Judith Warner called Perfect Madness, and she called it the mess. And this is, you know, these phrases, the overwhelm, the mess, were used to describe what it feels like to be a parent, particularly a mother today. So there's definitely something out there. I think people are realizing that they're exhausted. This isn't sustainable. Something needs to change. And, you know, maybe our kids will be okay without doing it all.
Alyssa, as a hard-boiled media interviewer, I got to ask, did you take your own advice? Did you send out some of those personal letters to a select few relatives and friends this year?
I have to admit, I did neither.
Is it because you're too busy?
Yes, it is. It is. I have a toddler and a husband that's been has a full-time job and finishing a book all at once. So I feel
it's a
like
whirlwind.
This year,
does he have a publisher? No.
Oh, yes, oh. He does. Yeah, he's.
See, you got material right there for a letter, actually.
Yeah. So I feel like everyone could forgive me from this year. I was not my best holiday self this year on many levels.
Well,
but
Alyssa,
next year I plan on it.
All right. Well, next year, of course. Well, Alyssa, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Alyssa Strauss writes about gender and culture for theweek.com.
You know, I'm just lazy. I always think, oh, I'm going to do that mass holiday letter that she said not to do, and I never get around to it. Not because I'm too busy.
Now you have an excuse not to do it, I guess.
Now. Okay, laziness is a virtue in this case. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Mike Arnold, and for Veronica Rickard. As we count down to the new year, we'll be taking a look back at some of the big stories and trends of 2014 over the next week. Yesterday, we checked out the year in words and language. Coming up on Friday, the top state and national news stories. And next Monday, we review the year in science.
And now, a look at music. We called up Stephen Thompson from NPR Music. He joins us on Central Time from time to time to share some great songs. He's turned us on to a lot of great stuff. Today, he brings his top 10 songs of 2014. Stephen's an editor and reviewer for NPR Music and a panelist on the Pop Culture Happy Hour and All Songs Considered. Stephen, welcome back.
Oh, it's nice to be here, guys.
Well, before we get to your top 10 tracks for 2014, and you've got some great ones, did you see any big trends and themes emerging in the music world this last year?
Well, one thing that really jumped out at me was the way the shadow of 2013 kind of hung over this year in music like an awning. You had the big pop hits of the year, like Happy by Pharrell and Let It Go from Frozen, came out last year and just wouldn't go away. And if you're looking at just top 40, if you're looking at pop music, it was really about 2013 not really being able to be shed. And actually, one thing that I put down as one of my 10 favorite pop songs one of my 10 favorite songs of 2014 is actually on an album that came out so late last year that I couldn't include it in my top 10 list. And that's, speaking of pop, the Beyoncé record.
And well, let's check out, you've got a Beyoncé track for us. Let's jump right in. This is XO by Beyoncé.
Your love is bright as ever, even in the shadows. Baby, kiss me.
So, Stephen, what is it about this? This is the poppiest one, I think, from your list this year. What is it about this one that grabbed you?
Well, this particular song swells and swells and gets bigger and bigger. And part of what I love in pop music is when it's soaring and grandiose and vaguely fatalistic. It has this, it just builds and builds so beautifully. I actually really love this Beyoncé record. I know that she's a big pop star and you know, we're also supposed to turn up our noses, but that record is fantastic.
Now, you know, Beyoncé is pretty popular on the charts. We mentioned Happy and some other songs. Are there songs from the past year that were pop hits that you think will actually last longer than, say, Gangnam Style lasted?
Well, I think...
What do you mean, man? That's still with us.
I don't know that we're all still rocking the Gangnam Style. I think this Taylor Swift record that came out kind of late in the year, that was sort of the first big pop record that kind of finally flushed away so many of these songs from 2013 that we couldn't quite get rid of. I mean, Happy by Pharrell came out in the summer of 2013, and it's still reverberating on the wind. But I think the Taylor Swift record, as much as, again, you know, it's this total pop confection, and, you know, and she's somebody who often isn't taken very seriously. I think that's a very sturdy collection of songs, and we're still going to be trying to shake off those Taylor Swift hits late into 2015.
Well, the accountants in the music industry definitely took that album seriously. I mean, this is one that people were hoping to be the blockbuster of the year, right? Taylor Swift's new album.
And it has been. It's the first million selling album since the last time Taylor Swift put out a record. So she's a juggernaut. Even though music sales are so depressed, she's one of the few who can still sell, you know, a million, 2 million in a way that I think if she had come out 25 years ago, these records would be selling 10 million, 15 million.
And part of that's because she got out of things like Spotify, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think to a certain extent, she's a big enough fish that she's able to step out of the music streaming circle and still be able to sell a lot of records. I'm not sure if it's totally cause and effect there or not, but you know, certainly on Spotify, you know, artists aren't making as much money as they would if they were selling music.
Well, Stephen, I want to get further into your list, and this is part of what I like about having you on. My tendency is a great band comes out, and I discover it, 5 to 10 years later, if ever. But thanks to you, I've actually gotten on board, with albums that have just come out. So I want to get into some of your other top 10 picks. Tell us a little bit before we give a listen. We've got a song from Sylvan Esso, a song called Coffee. Tell us about it, and then we'll give it a listen.
Yeah, Sylvan Esso is this wonderful electronic folk pop duo. The singer is a woman named Amelia Meath, who has sung in an mostly a cappella group called Mountain Man. And Nick Sanborn has played in Megaphone and has a few Wisconsin ties to him as well. But when they work together, they make this very melancholy, beautiful, very catchy. It's dance music, but it's got this kind of sinister quality, not sinister, just kind of sinewy quality as well. I just love it. Coffee is just this beautiful song that I kept coming back to all year long.
This is Coffee by Sylvan Esso. Stuff going on back there, Stephen.
Yeah, and as that song unfolds, it reveals more hooks on top of hooks, and it becomes very big and throbbing, but still sad. The more you pick it apart lyrically, the more it kind of makes you stop and question your existence, which is my favorite kind of song.
You enjoy being questioning your existence. Is that,
I enjoy constantly pondering my place on this earth.
Well, I'm originally from Indiana, and one of the things when you're from Indiana, you're doomed because John Cougar Mellencamp sort of overrides all of the music in the state. and I was actually impressed that you were able to find somebody on your list who's from Indiana and sort of moves things in a different direction, and that's Strand of Oaks. Could you tell me a little bit about that group?
Yeah, Strand of Oaks is mostly this guy named Timothy Showalter, and he's made a lot of kind of, you know, bedroom confessional, you know, folk music, and this record that he put out called Heal has a lot of bigger rock bandier songs. And the song that I pick, which is one of my very favorites of the year, is called JM. And he wrote it about one of his favorite singer-songwriters and one of my favorite singer-songwriters, Jason Molina, who used to record as Songs Ohio or Magnolia Electric Company. And Jason Molina died last year at 39. And this song that's a tribute to him is just this beautiful reflection on the way music can burrow deeply under our skin, and it's an appreciation that where you really feel the gratitude toward the artist. I love this song. So this is Strand of Oaks, and the song is called JM.
Cleaning off the ash, but I had your sweet tunes to play. Them in.
Now, Stephen, one of your colleagues at NPR, Bob Boylan, I think, said that this song sounds a lot like Cortez the Killer by Neil Young. Would you say that's true?
I think that's a very, very apt comparison. And what the passage from it that we heard is one of the quieter kind of build-up points to where it unleashes this thunderous, very crazy horse guitar raging. And so it, to me, it not only is very reminiscent of Cortez the Killer, but it's also true to the sound of a lot of Jason Molina's music, especially his later stuff. And so it's paying tribute on a number of levels.
Now, Stephen, you have a habit of picking songs with a lot of different parts and build-ups and stuff. That makes it really hard to pick the one representative sample. But
yeah, I don't make it easy for you to pull out 5 seconds.
But this one actually kind of comes in strong and keeps it through. Now, this one you shared with us in the past, and I have loved the album since you introduced me to it. This is from the New Pornographers album, the new Pornographers album. This song is Brill Bruisers. Give a listen here. Stephen, I think the whole album carries through the momentum here. You agree, I assume?
Yeah, I love it. I was writing about this record recently, and I realized that so much of the appeal of this album is all there in the first 1 second of that song. It just has this, like, shwoomp. And you're immediately fully immersed in it. And, you know, from there, it slows down in spots, but you really are just, the ride begins literally within the first second.
Well, we're talking to Stephen Thompson from NPR Music about some of the greatest songs of 2014. He's sharing his top 10 list, and you can join in right now, too.
We want to hear your suggestions of great music, either new in 2014 or perhaps new to you. In 2014, maybe you're like me and discover stuff a little bit later. What did you find that you got into in the last year? You can call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post over at the Central Time Facebook page.
We continue our look into the year in music with Stephen Thompson from NPR. He's sharing some of his favorite songs of the year.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Share either your favorite new song or maybe album from this year, or something that's new to you, something that you just discovered this year, or maybe is there a song you could have done without? You can call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll get back to some of Stephen's picks in a moment, but let's go to our phones. And we've got Bill on the line in Waukesha. Bill, hi there.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What are you listening to this year?
Well, lately I've been listening to Hank Williams III. And he's a little dark and... little backwoodsish, but he's kind of comical as he sings as well.
And he'd been at it for a while. What got you into him this year?
Well, I don't know, maybe that genre in general, and with Pandora, you know, different songs come up and different artists come up that maybe you haven't listened to in a while, and so he started becoming a little more catchy for me.
And so Hank Williams III is Hank Williams Jr.'s son, who
Correct.
Is Hank Williams. So it's like three generations.
Right.
Yeah, that lineage
Go ahead, Bill.
Go ahead, Stephen.
Oh, I said he sounds more like his grandfather and kind of looks like his grandfather.
Bill,
well,
thanks.
They say it skips a generation, you know.
Definitely. Well, Bill, thanks a lot for the call. And Stephen, Bill is doing something that I do. I'll use these online things to catch up with bands that I probably should have listened to back then. Do you have something like that, Stephen, that you are rediscovering now, even if it's not brand spanking new?
You know, it's actually really hard to get to do that because I'm constantly listening I'm listening to more 2015 music right now than I am anything before 2014. But it's interesting that you guys brought up Hank III. Hank III, I believe it's his half-sister, Holly Williams, put out one of my favorite records of 2013. So that lineage is still producing, I think... you know, some amazing music.
So Hank the Third, how long has he been out there?
It's been around a while. I would say probably 15 or 20 years.
Wow.
Well,
completely missed him, so I'm putting it on the list.
Yeah, and remember,
really good outlaw country. If you like your country to have an outlaw kind of a rock edge to it, he's your man.
You can share your favorite new music or new to you music in 2014, 800-642-1234, or head on over to the Central Time Facebook page. Stephen, a band that was not new to me. I'd heard a previous album, Alt J, I think from Britain, a new song, Warm Foothills. Tell us a little bit about Alt J before we give a listen.
Yeah, Alt J is a big up-and-coming band. They won the Mercury Prize for their first album. And the vocals by this guy, Joe Newman, have always thrown me off. They're always a little too kind of squeaky and adenoidal and weird for me. This particular record, This Is All Yours, they tone that down, and it's very atmospheric and beautiful. And the song that I picked is called Warm Foothills. He actually not only trades lines with other singers, he actually trades words. And so a different vocalist will take each word, and it's very haunting and very, very beautiful.
All right, Warm Foothills by Alt J.
Dryden skater for jumping. From the nape of her neck,
he made his descent.
They watched men hurl from rocks.
So there's a good taste of what you're talking about, jumping back and forth. What I had heard of Alt J in the past was a lot more jarring, driving, weird stuff coming out of nowhere. This is very pretty and melodic. Is that characteristic of this new album?
Yeah, I think it's a much prettier record. There is some pretty stuff on the first record, but it's a little bit slinkier. It's a little more, you know, kind of gets under your skin. This record is very, very atmospheric.
Could we listen to one more here, actually? There's a Tiny Ruins, which is kind of has the same sort of feel to it that you have on the list, which is Me at the Museum, You at the Winter Garden. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's a band from New Zealand. There were two records like this that I listened to all year long. The other one was my favorite album of the year, this band called Luluk. But Tiny Ruins, it's just this beautiful, these melancholy ballads. And you know, for me, I tend to go to extremes. I either love my music like that New Pornographer song where it's just big and brash and just right out of the gate, or I love this quieter, more reflective stuff. And this is a very, very, just not just because it has winter in the title, this is a very wintry song.
So no half measures for Stephen Thompson.
That's
Tiny
right.
Ruins, Me at the Museum, You at the Winter Gardens.
I await the day when I work at the museum with you across the way.
So that, I mean, you were talking about how, you know, the Alt J's sounding more is that a trend? Is that something that's happening where everybody, I mean, because it kind of reminds me of like Belle and Sebastian or something like that. Has that happened in music?
I think a lot of musicians, as more and more of them are recording at their homes and in their bedrooms, and that the equipment necessary to record an album is more available in kind of a portable way where you're not going into a sterile recording studio, I do think you get more reflective music as a result. I'm not saying that's necessarily what happened with Alt J or Tiny Ruins or Luluk or any of these slower, quieter bands that I'm loving, but I do think that does create an ecosystem for some quieter music.
Let's go back to our callers. You've got Ryan on the line with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What do you got for us?
I'm talking about a couple of local bands here that one has critical acclaim, Field Report.
Sure.
Fronted by Christopher Porterfield. And another band that I actually had the pleasure to mix their record was, they're called Buffalo Gospel, folk Americana country style. All just great Porterfield's more ethereal, and Buffalo Gospel's just heart-wrenching, absolutely heart-wrenching. And that's a band that I just can see blowing up sooner than later.
Ryan, thanks a lot for those Wisconsin-based suggestions. Yeah. Stephen, not getting into the specific bands, but the joy of going out and catching that local act, is that a lost art, or are people still going out and getting those, seeing those bands in person before they're big?
Oh, well, you know, that's one of the things that you can never digitize, you know, the experience of going out to, you know, to a club or a bar or your friend's house or wherever these bands are performing and having that sense of discovery. One of my favorite Wisconsin bands of this year is Fox, you know, P-H-O-X. They started in Baraboo. They've been based in Madison. And that's an incredibly charming record. The Field Report is really, really, really good. I do not know Buffalo Gospel. And while Ryan was talking, I was writing down Buffalo Gospel on my little my little notepad. So, you know, you never stop discovering great music.
Well, Stephen, we're just about out of time. Anything you're looking forward to in particular in 2015 before we let you go?
Well, I mean, I'm still digesting the end of 2014, just like happened last year. All of a sudden, there are all these big, important records that are taking some time to unpack. You know, there's this new D'Angelo record. There's a new Nicki Minaj record, a new J. Cole record. And then, you know, coming up in 2015, there's the first Modest Mouse record in 8 years. There's a new album by Laura Marling, who is a singer I just love. So I love it. I love to always be swimming in it. I never like it to slow down.
Well, look forward to you sharing some of those songs with us next year. Stephen, thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Thank you, guys.
That's Stephen Thompson. He's an editor and reviewer for NPR Music, frequent guest on this show, and you can catch him on NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour and also on All Songs Considered. All right, we got Christmas, Hanukkah, New Year's Eve, Kwanzaa, a whole lot of holidays in late December. But let's not overlook a more recent addition to the pantheon. Today, December 23rd, is Festivus.
That's right. The holiday was popularized back in the 90s. Remember the 90s? The hit TV show Seinfeld. Festivus was invented by the family of one of the show's writers. Here's Jerry Stiller as Frank Costanza explaining some of the high points.
You gather your family around and tell them all the ways they have disappointed you over the past year.
And is there a tree?
No, instead there's a pole. Requires no decoration. I find tinsel distracting.
Frank, this new holiday of yours is scratching me right where I itch.
Let's do it then.
All right.
Festivus is back! I'll get the pole out of the crawl space.
In addition to airing of grievances and the Festivus poll, there was also feats of strength, including wrestling against the head of the household.
And I gather some people are actually celebrating Festivus as kind of a non-commercial alternative to the holidays. And I found a Wisconsin connection. So at the Wisconsin Historical Society, they've got an artifact, Governor Doyle's Festivus poll. A company donated that back in 2005. Then Governor Jim Doyle displayed it at the Capitol, then donated it to the Historical Society after the holiday. Mike, Festivus plans this year?
No.
Yeah, me neither. Maybe next year. It's a lazy man's holiday.